Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Okay, let's dive in. We're looking today at, well, really one of the most fascinating and maybe even paradoxical life stories in recent American history. We're drawing a lot from Jimmy Carter's own reflections, especially his memoir, A Full Life, Reflections at 90.
Right. And our mission here, really, is to wrestle with the big question about James Earl Jimmy Carter Jr. Why is his lasting impact, his legacy, defined so much less by his presidency those years from 1977 to 81, and so much more by the decades, nearly 40 years, of just relentless global service that came after?
It's this incredible story of reinvention, isn't it? You have a peanut farmer from a small town who reaches the absolute highest office, then faces this really crushing defeat,
yeah,
and then chooses to channel all that influence, that power, that fame towards humanitarian work instead. It's an amazing pivot.
It is. And what's so interesting and what the sources really trace well is that this second act wasn't just random. It feels more like a moral pilgrimage. You know, it's this blend of his Southern roots, that really rigorous engineering mind, and this deep, quiet faith. He offers this, well, pretty unique model of integrity in public life that feels important to understand today.
So let's start at the beginning then. Plains, Georgia. We're talking Depression era, rural South, hard work, but also rigid racial segregation, the whole Jim Crow system. How did that place shape him?
Well, you really see two powerful, almost opposing forces shaping him early on. You have his father, Earl Carter, a successful businessman, very disciplined. He passed on that practical business sense, that drive.
Okay.
But then there's his mother, Lillian Gordy Carter. She was quite the outlier for her time and place, a registered nurse, very progressive views. She treated black patients and white patients exactly the same, which was, well, it was a quiet defiance of those Jim Crow rules.
Mm-hmm.
She modeled a kind of service that went beyond those racial lines.
Mm-hmm. That's a key contrast. Discipline from the father, this sort of moral compass from the mother. And his path out of Plains wasn't just chance. It took real ambition, real discipline. Getting into the United States Naval Academy in 43,
mm-hmm.
graduating in the top 10%, that discipline was clearly there early.
Absolutely. And that discipline then leads him to what might be the single most formative intellectual experience of his life, the nuclear submarine program.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, working under Admiral Hyman Rickover.
Ah, Rickover. Legendary figure.
Legendary and famously demanding. A perfectionist. He wasn't just training engineers. He was forging leaders who understood absolute standards, absolute accountability.
Tell me more about that. What does that absolute standard really mean in practice? How does, you know, designing a submarine reactor translate to mediating peace talks decades later?
It's about total intellectual honesty. Rickover's whole process demanded absolute precision. If a calculation was off even slightly, the consequences could be, well, catastrophic. So Carter learned this incredibly methodical, data-driven way of tackling problems.
Mm.
He learned to break down these massively complex systems, whether it's a reactor or later a government budget, or even a really tense diplomatic situation, into parts you can actually manage, variables you can solve for. It fundamentally shaped his leadership style.
But that whole naval career gets cut short, right? 1953, his father dies. He has to resign his commission, go back to Plains, save the family peanut farm.
Right. And that decision, that's a major turning point. He gives up this really high-flying, ambitious naval career out of a sense of duty, duty to family, duty to community.
Mm.
And it forces him, really forces him, to reconnect with the day-to-day economic and social realities of the South mm. in a way that staying in the Navy never would have. It grounded him.
And that grounding, maybe his mother's influence too, nudges him into politics, Georgia State Senate in 62. And he takes a public stand against segregation pretty early on, positioning himself as part of this new South. That couldn't have been the easy path politically back then.
No, not at all. It took real courage. And that stance eventually leads to his famous inaugural speech as governor in 1970, where he declares, flat out, the time for racial discrimination is over.
Powerful statement.
And as governor, he wasn't just about progressive ideals on race. He showed he was a competent administrator,
mm-hmm.
you know, streamlining government, focusing on environmental protection. He proved he could actually run things effectively.
Right. The engineering mindset again.
Exactly.
And that record, plus the national mood after Watergate, kind of propels him onto the national stage in 76. He plays up the outsider thing, makes that simple promise, I will never lie to you.
And it worked. It resonated. His presidency, though, it was tough. Big economic problems, the energy crisis looming large.
Yeah.
But it did have one absolutely defining high point, the Camp David Accords in 1978.
The peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. Historic.
Truly historic. And you see that Rickover influence again, but applied to diplomacy.
How so? What did that look like?
Well, it wasn't just about the big picture. Carter got deep into the details. He knew the briefing books inside and out. He applied that engineering-like precision to the negotiations, systematically tackling the roadblocks.
Okay, the methodical part.
But, and this is crucial, he combined that rigor with real empathy, the personal touch. Things like writing personal notes to Menachem Begin's grandchildren, it was that combination, that validation of the human element alongside the intense, detailed pressure that finally broke the deadlock after 13 days.
An incredible achievement. But despite that, as you said, the economy, the Iranian hostage crisis, it led to that really crushing defeat in 1980. And this is the point, right, where most political careers just fade away.
Mm-hmm.
But for Carter, it becomes the launch pad for this, well, unprecedented second act.
Exactly. Founding the Carter Center in 1982, it just completely redefined what an ex-presidency could be. It wasn't about sitting on boards or just writing memoirs anymore. It was about active, aggressive engagement on global peace, human rights, and maybe most visibly, these measurable global health campaigns.
And the image that sticks with everyone, I think, is him with Habitat for Humanity. Decades of work, hammer in hand. Why was that so important, psychologically maybe, for a former president to be out there physically building houses?
Well, I think it represents that accountability we talked about. It's this visible statement
right.
that leadership isn't just about strategy meetings and giving orders. It's also about tangible contribution, rolling up your sleeves. The hammer becomes this perfect symbol, really, for both his applied Christianity and that engineering mindset, like, you know, building, fixing, getting measurable results.
And the results, especially in health, are just staggering. The sources talk about the near eradication of guinea worm disease. It went from, what, 3.5 million cases in 1986 down to fewer than 50 recently? That's incredible.
It's a monumental public health victory. And it perfectly illustrates that engineering approach on a global scale. It wasn't a quick fix. It was this long-term systematic effort involving education, clean water infrastructure, painstaking work. That kind of dedication, achieving that kind of measurable success, that's what really solidified his legacy and led to the Nobel Peace Prize in 2002.
It's the ultimate vindication in a way. So let's dig a bit deeper into the why. We've touched on the engineering, the faith, the upbringing. Can we synthesize the core pillars of his worldview that fueled this kind of decades-long dedication?
Yeah, I think there are three main pillars, and they're always interacting. First, there's what you might call applied Christianity. His faith isn't just internal. It's deeply rooted in social justice. We mentioned liberation theology in action earlier.
Right.
And what that means, practically, is focusing on translating belief into actual concrete efforts for the poor, the sick, the oppressed. It's almost like an operational manual for putting faith into practice.
So faith demands action, not just belief.
Precisely. Then the second pillar is that engineering mindset we keep coming back to. Approaching these huge, complex problems, disease, conflict with data, with systematic planning, and this underlying belief that rational negotiation, finding common ground, can actually work. He brought a scientist's rigor to messy human problems.
Okay, but doesn't the idealism of the faith part sometimes clash with the hard-nosed realism of the engineer? How did he square, say, a strong human rights stance with pragmatic politics?
Ah, that's where the third pillar comes in. Democratic idealism. He had this fundamental belief in the ability of ordinary people to govern themselves effectively and wisely. So things like his human rights policy or his later work monitoring elections weren't just moral positions. They were practical steps towards building the stable democratic systems where rational progress, the engineer's goal, could actually happen. He used the engineering method, you could say, to try and achieve the moral vision. It's like a feedback loop.
So his driving force wasn't just ambition or politics. It was more like a deep sense of calling, a moral duty to use the unique position he found himself in for the benefit of others, and all fueled by a kind of quiet optimism.
I think that's right. He seemed to maintain this belief in the possibility of positive change, even when things looked incredibly bleak globally.
Let's try and crystallize his journey by looking at three really pivotal turning points, moments that fundamentally shifted his path. We talked about the return to planes in 53, but let's revisit its full weight.
The key thing about the return was that it was a deliberate choice of duty over ambition. Giving up the Navy, that apparent setback, it completely immersed him back in the realities of his local community. It grounded him, taught him about the real economy, and cemented this focus on family and community responsibility that really set the stage for his later entry into local politics.
Okay, that makes sense. Then the second big shift, the born-again experience in 1967, This came after a political low point, losing the governor's race in 66.
Right, a devastating loss for him.
And it leads to the spiritual renewal. How does that fit with the analytical engineering side we've been talking about?
Well, that loss really shook him. The spiritual renewal, which was also deepened by the death of his sister Ruth around that time, it didn't replace the engineer, but it gave the engineer a clearer why, a moral compass. The transformation was that politics stopped being just a career ladder and became truly a calling to serve. That moral clarity guided him through everything that followed, the White House and beyond.
It provided the foundation. And the third turning point, Camp David, 1978. We know the outcome was historic, but what made that moment transformative for Carter himself?
I think it validated his core belief that principled negotiation backed by intense preparation could actually work. The transformation for him was seeing proof that these huge, seemingly impossible international conflicts could be resolved through this unique blend of his, that meticulous, detail-oriented pressure combined with genuine personal empathy. It really gave him the template and the confidence for all the diplomatic work he'd do later with the Carter Center.
Those are powerful moments, and they teach us a lot, I think, about the human experience. Maybe the biggest lesson is resilience. How that crushing political defeat in 1980 actually became the catalyst for his greatest achievements.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He just refused to let that loss be the final word. That moment of rejection basically forced him to reassess. Where could his unique skills, that precision, that moral drive, the global access of a former president, be used most effectively away from the constraints of day-to-day politics? He literally transformed political failure into this unprecedented wave of humanitarian success. That conscious choice, that refocusing, that's really a masterclass in resilience.
And we can't talk about his life without mentioning the power of partnership.
Mm-hmm.
His relationship with Rosalynn Carter over 75 years together.
Yes, crucial. She wasn't just a supportive spouse in the background. She was a full strategic partner. Co-led the Carter Center, spearheaded major initiatives like mental health advocacy. She was deeply involved in the decision making. Their partnership really modeled this blend of sort of traditional stability with a very modern sense of equality and shared purpose. That was undoubtedly a huge factor in his long-term effectiveness and, well, his endurance.
And one final lesson, perhaps. Principled courage. He often took stands that were morally right but politically difficult, like the human rights focus or pushing through the Panama Canal treaties, which were deeply unpopular at the time.
Yeah, his career really shows that integrity, even if it costs you politically in the short run, is what builds a truly lasting and respected legacy. He seemed willing to do what he thought was right, even if it meant losing an election. That takes courage.
This has been a really rich exploration of service, purpose, and, well, reinvention. Let's wrap up by leaving our listener with three clear takeaways that capture Carter's unique impact. First, an emotional insight.
The emotional insight, I think, is seeing that journey from despair after the 1980 loss to finding this profound new purpose. It's powerful proof that a really devastating professional setback doesn't have to be the end. It can actually be the very thing that pushes you toward your true, most enduring contribution.
Okay. And the intellectual insight.
Intellectually, it's how he completely redefined the post-presidency. The truly radical idea that a leader's greatest global impact might actually come after leaving office when they're free from partisan battles and daily political pressures, that's a fundamental shift in thinking about leadership.
A powerful idea. And finally, a universal insight, something anyone can apply.
That comes right back to Admiral Rickover, doesn't it? That relentlessly simple question he posed to Carter, did you always do your best? And when Carter had to admit, no, not always, Rickover's follow-up, why not? That's the core lesson, isn't it? Personal accountability, the relentless striving for excellence, no matter what you're doing, that applies to absolutely everything in life.
It really does. Carter's life ultimately challenges all of us, I think, to think about how we measure success. Maybe it's less about the power we gain and more about the service we actually give.
Well said. His life's value really is measured in that lifetime of dedication to his principles. In an age that can feel pretty cynical, Carter's decades of quiet, persistent work are kind of a powerful reminder that decency, principle, and sustained effort can still lead to a truly full, impactful life on a global scale.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.